This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Are the climate deniers right? Are some scientists colluding with the government to hide the truth about climate change? Yes, according to top British scientist Kevin Anderson, but not the scandal you've heard about. Top scientists and government reports won't tell you we're heading towards catastrophic climate change. Emissions are skidding out of control, leading us to a world perhaps 6 degrees hotter on average, much faster than anyone thought possible. Why doesn't the public know? Why are world conferences still talking about staying below 2 degrees as though that is possible? I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. In a devastating speech at Bristol University, Tuesday, November 6th, Dr. Kevin Anderson accused too many climate scientists of keeping quiet about the unrealistic assessments put out by governments and about our awful odds of reaching global warming far above the proposed 2 degrees safe point. In fact, says Anderson, we're almost guaranteed to reach 4 degrees of warming as early as 2050, just 40 years away, and may soar beyond that, beyond the point which agriculture, the ecosystem, and industrial civilization, they won't be able to survive. All this comes from one of the world's top climate scientists plugged into the latest research and numbers. Dr. Kevin Anderson is from the UK's premier climate modeling institution, the Tyndall Centre, and he teaches at the University of Manchester. He delivered the speech, Real Clothes for the Emperor, Facing the Challenges of Climate Change, at the Cabot Institute at the University of Bristol in Britain. In this program, I'm going to play selections from Kevin Anderson's latest speech, accompanied by some explanation and references to other sources. Anderson speaks very quickly, assuming a highly informed European audience, and includes some technical data and reports unknown to most of us. So we're going to work through this together. Here's how he begins.
Why I think the Emperor is streaking in front of us naked, while most of us are sort of saying, aren't they beautifully attired, including many scientists. I think actually if you stand up and say the climate change emperor is naked, most people will shut you down. They do not want to hear that, however obvious it may be. So I think as an analogy, it really works quite well. So it's real close to the emperor, trying to think, what do we need to do to ensure that the emperor can stay warm, or cool perhaps in a climate change world? So discussing this in relation to climate change. I want to set a context up to start off with for this. Right, this is from that well-known left-wing think tank, the International Energy Agency. This is from their chief economist. This is the conventional wisdom here. We're on track for a 3.5 degrees C temperature rise by 2040, and they're looking at that compared with today, so compared with pre-industrial times, that's a 4 degrees C or so rise by around the middle of the century. That's what we're on track for at the moment, according to the IEA. When Fatih Birol looks at this data, the trend is perfectly in line with a temperature increase of 6 degrees Celsius. By the end of the century, that is, which would be have devastating consequences for the planet. So the IEA are saying we're heading towards a 6 degrees C future, 6 degrees C global mean surface temperature rise. Today, I think it was today or yesterday, PwC, PricewaterhouseCooper, put out a report where they're saying also that we're online for 6 degrees C. I mean, I have to say, I think it's been pretty obvious the last 10 years that's where we're pointing towards. But it is interesting to see orthodox organisations coming out and saying this now. Birol went on to say we have 5 years to change the energy system, or have it changed. So it'll either be changed by the climate and by the environment around us, or we can actually start to change it. Now, note it says energy system. It's not just about supply. So real credit here to the IEA for thinking about this quite differently, prepared to stand up and say things that many of us would not agree with. The Copenhagen Accord, hopefully most of you are familiar with this, is what we signed up to, including most nations around the world have signed up to this, and in fact it was broadly followed by the Cancun Agreement. Now, they're not legally binding, but like all international agreements, they're never really legally binding. But this is interesting, because I think it actually says something quite important about how we see climate change. To hold the increase in global temperature below 2 degrees Celsius, notice below, not a 50-50 chance of, below 2 degrees Celsius, and take action to meet this objective, consistent with the science, that's quite radical, and on the basis of equity, even more radical. And most nations have signed up to this, so I think we should always hold our leaders to account. Yeah, hold that in front of them. and point out what it says. Science, equity, and that we stay below 2 degrees C, not a 50-50 chance of it.
Kevin Anderson has brought up a new study from the most unexpected source, the report by PricewaterhouseCoopers, the generally conservative giant accounting company, is titled Too Late for 2 Degrees? Joe Rome at thinkprogress.org has an excellent summary posted November 6th titled Study, We're Headed to 11 Degrees Fahrenheit Warming and Even 7 Degrees Fahrenheit Requires, quote, nearly quadrupling the current rate of decarbonization, end quote. The main conclusion in the PricewaterhouseCoopers study reads, quote, our low carbon economy index evaluates the rate of decarbonization of the global economy that is needed to limit warming to 2 degrees centigrade. This report shows that global carbon intensity decreased between 2000 and 2011 by about 0.8% a year. In 2011, carbon intensity decreased by 0.7%. The global economy now needs to cut carbon intensity by 5.1% every year from now to 2050. Keeping to the 2-degree carbon budget will require sustained and unprecedented reductions over four decades. Governments' ambitions to limit warming to 2 degrees centigrade appear highly unrealistic. And that's the end of that quote from the big accounting company. And then they say, quote, we have passed a critical threshold. Not once since 1950 has the world achieved that rate of decarbonization in a single year, but the task now confronting us is to achieve it for 39 consecutive years. Even to have a reasonable prospect of getting to the 4 degrees scenario would imply nearly quadrupling the current rate of decarbonization, end quote. Joe Rome reminds us our speaker Kevin Anderson has already written about the 7 degree Fahrenheit increase in global mean temperature. It is, quote, incompatible with organized global community, is likely to be beyond adaptation, is devastating to the majority of ecosystems, and has a high probability of not being stable. That is, 4 degrees centigrade or 7 degrees Fahrenheit would be an interim temperature on the way to a much higher equilibrium level. That's what Kevin Anderson wrote. And I'd like to just keep reading out Joe Rome's excellent if horrifying article, but I'll leave that up to you, except for this from Joe. Quote, such a world would mean permanent dust bowl conditions over the U.S. Southwest, parts of the Great Plains, and many other regions around the globe that are heavily populated and/or heavily farmed. Sea level rise of some 1 foot by 2050 and then 4 to 6 feet or more by 2100, rising some 6 to 12 inches or more each decade hereafter. Massive species loss on land and sea, perhaps 50% or more of all biodiversity. Much more extreme weather. These will all be happening simultaneously and getting worse decade after decade. A 2009 NOAA-led study found the worst impacts would be, quote, largely irreversible for 1,000 years, end quote, from NOAA. In such a world, there would be little prospect for feeding 9 billion people post-2050, given current dietary, economic, and agricultural practices. The word adaptation simply doesn't apply in any meaningful sense. And that's Joe Rome, and he's writing about what happens if we go above 4 degrees centigrade or 7 degrees Fahrenheit of warming. And I put a link to that hair-raising piece by Joe at thinkprogress.org in my own show blog at ecoshock.info. And remember, you can download the entire one-hour speech by Kevin Anderson at the University of Bristol from that blog as well. Please do. Meanwhile, we'll continue with selections from Anderson's speech to the Cabot Institute on November 6th. Now, I know I shouldn't be surprised the climate is spinning out of control. After all, the Swiss reinsurance company, Munich Re, warned the 2-degree alleged safety limit was, quote, no longer attainable, end quote. But that was published in a periodical called Insurance Daily. Perhaps, like me, you missed that. A continuing message from Kevin Anderson is we've all been led astray by a general fog coming out of a combination of convenient climate science, reports from governments, the United Nations, and those conferences that continued with big language and no results as emissions continued to rise. No wonder the public doesn't know. As Kevin Anderson will tell us, those who do know are conspiring to keep us from the awful truth. Here is what is actually happening with our greenhouse gas emissions.
Now, it's worth noting the economic downturn. In 2009-10, global emissions went up by 5.9%. That was at the start of the economic downturn, 5.9%. I think that's higher than at any point during the Industrial Revolution. And even the following 2 years, 2010 to 11, went up by about 3.2%, and this year probably a little bit below 3%, maybe 2.6%. We haven't got the final data on that yet. But despite the economic downturn, we're still seeing emissions rise, keep going up and up. So what are the future for emissions? Well, let's just think about the energy system. Most of my work and most of what I'm going to talk about today relates to energy. If we build a power station, if we build oil rigs, gas platforms, which I used to work on, they generally last for 25 to 50 years if they're reasonably well built. If we build infrastructures, this building itself, grid networks, pipe works, sewage systems, those sorts of things, road networks, train networks, they're going to last for 30 to 100 years. So once you put them in place, that's typically how long you expect to see them live. If you build an aircraft and sell it, or a ship, you normally expect to see that living for about, and operating for about 30 years. So these things really lock you in to the future of the next numerous decades. So if we think about those supply network, and remember, most of the world now is fitting that like there's no tomorrow, and we're not changing ours, we're living with what we've got and just modifying it a little bit. But the rest of the world is trying to build this as fast as possible. China at the moment is building about 150 international airports, which we can't blame the Chinese, because we'll be flying in and out of them, no doubt. So 150 international airports. If they flew as much as we did, they'd require 450. Now, most of that for academics, I think.
Anderson goes on to list a host of climate and economic reports coming from governments, big institutes, and universities that use obviously false lowball numbers for greenhouse gas emissions. The famous British Stern Report in 2006, for example, used an emissions level growth of 0.95% per year. The actual rates for that period from 2000 to 2005 were more than three times higher than that. Stern had access to the latest figures. Anyone could find them on the web. Why didn't he use the actual facts? Using lower numbers helped a number of agencies and governments achieve much more palatable predictions, leaving lots of time for us and Western societies to make small, tiny changes while adapting. Quite the opposite was true based on the real numbers. Counting the growth of emissions from China and the developing world, the developed West and Japan were and actually are entirely out of time to slowly reduce emissions. As Anderson calculates, to preserve a relatively safe climate below 2 degrees, the emissions of the developed countries had to drop to zero by 2010. I won't list out all the official reports from Britain, Europe, America that used that phony low emissions figures plus wild overestimates of all kinds to get results that pleased the sitting politicians and big business board members. Kevin Anderson gives you all the details in his speech. Just as the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche supposed it takes some ideas a long time to penetrate society, he compared it to the time light takes to arrive from distant stars, our public dialogue is missing this critical fact that Anderson reveals again and again. We are heading towards a catastrophe. No kidding around about that. That's what's coming. That cities and agriculture and civilization cannot survive. Then Anderson reveals a startling twist on what we need to do now. He says we don't have time to implement large-scale alternatives. We need not focus so much on the supply side, like the tar sands, the Arctic oil, the frack gas, alternative energy, or nuclear power. Those technologies all take more time to implement than we have to save the climate. Anderson concluded in a science paper published by the British Royal Society that only a planned economic downturn, accompanied by a severe energy austerity by the 1% who use the 50% of the world's energy, and that's us, can avoid this climate disaster. We needed to start action yesterday. We must campaign on the demand side. We still have time. Do each and every one of us drastically slash our energy use? It's a decision we can make.
That's somewhere in the region of 4 to 6 degree temperature rise by the end of the century. But we have to bear in mind that when we start talking about these higher temperatures, the science is very uncertain because there's a lot of other feedback issues there, a lot of non-linearities that are very complicated to understand. Probably you can't fully understand them at any point. But it looks that in the orthodox way of thinking of these issues, this is a very, very high temperature future. That's where we're heading to at the moment. Just out of interest, that's the 2 degrees C we've signed up to. So that's what we have to do for 2 degrees C, and that's the gap between, the void between. The rhetoric, here we are, rhetoric, there's some reality. There's another couple of bits I put on that. Just it's interesting that you can't, this is the supply bit, you can probably do something about supply, about energy supply within, say, 2025, 2030, 2040. You probably can't do anything about it this afternoon or in the next 5 or 10 years. Not significant. But you can do a lot about the demand side. So the argument we make repeatedly is that actually it's demand that really matters. And actually it's demand that brings the issue down to the local level. It's what we do that demands the energy. The supply side typically is a much more centralized issue and probably can't get away from that completely, whatever we do. And most demand technologies actually can change in 1 to 10 years. Most cars actually, most car journeys are traveled by cars that are under 8 years old, 90% pretty much of all vehicle kilometers. And behaviors, of course, can change instantly. We can change our behavior now if we wanted to. We can switch all this off and go home if we wanted to do that. There are lots of things we can do behaviorally. Just this is one quick one. If you want to provide light, these light bulbs are a very good example of that. If you want to provide light, you need electricity, a transmission network, a power station, and some Venezuelans to dig the coal out of the ground for you. So you put the light in here, 10 unit useful units of light using your lumens. Your light bulb here is 80% heat, 20% light, probably slightly better for halogen, but not much better. You'll lose 6 to 10%, probably 6 to 8% in your transmission and distribution network, most of it in the low voltage distribution system. Your power station will be at 35 to 45% efficient, and you'll lose 10% of your energy, at least getting the stuff out of the ground, onto a train, onto a chip, or over here, another train into the power station. So this actually says this is very much about an issue for us. We can do a huge amount here and have massive repercussions across the system.
As Anderson tells us, just to burn a 100-watt bulb demands several times that amount of energy down the power chain to mine the resource, transport it, burn it with only partial efficiency, and then lose another 50% or so in transmission. So turning off the bulb grows in impact all the way up the power chain if we can all cut back deeply and quickly. The result of that energy austerity, of course, when we stop buying useless consumer junk with all that embedded energy, is an economic crash. Is that better than a climate that wipes out at least half of all living species, possibly including ourselves? You be the judge.
And then this is from the Adam and Hume report, European report 2010. A low stabilization target of 400 ppmv CO2e, in other words, lower than we have today, can be achieved at moderate cost and a high likelihood of achieving this goal if you own a TARDIS. But, these are important government reports, and people are saying these sort of things. But they still look naked to me. I can't see any pants on the streaking emperor. So the alternative take that my colleague Alice Bowes and I have put out in a paper in 2008, I should say there, and indeed is in keeping with the IEA views today and the PwC views on this, it's difficult to envisage anything other than a planned economic recession. We were told that's too negative a term. We should have used the word contraction. But I think most people know what we mean. And being compatible with stabilisation at or below 650 parts per million CO2e, which is about 4 degrees C, there or thereabouts. So that's what we wrote in 2008. And then we revamped the analysis in 2011 for looking at the poorer parts of the world and the wealthy parts. And if you're going to peak emissions in globally by 2015 to 2016, which is where most analysis peaks emissions, this would require a prolonged period of austerity for Annex 1 nations, for the wealthy parts of the world. And that's not pulled out anywhere. Everyone always talks about win-win opportunities, green growth opportunities, all these wonderful expressions that are completely meaningless when you think about the curves I showed you at the beginning. It would also be quite a change in the development patterns for the poorer part, the non-Annex 1 parts of the world.
We must keep in mind that the target of keeping under 2 degrees centigrade of warming was always an arbitrary political decision. It doesn't necessarily guarantee a safe climate, as we are already finding out these days. The droughts, superfloods, superstorms like Sandy, and drastic meltback of Arctic sea ice all come when we are only officially approaching 1 degree of warming over pre-industrial times. 2 degrees gives us double that at the very least.
Remember, 2 degrees C is this threshold between acceptable and dangerous. That's not a scientific decision. It's a political, civil society, international fudge, like all of these things always are, of course. People coming together that's informed by science, but it's not a scientific decision that 2 degrees C is the appropriate or not the appropriate threshold. We have come collectively together, whether we like it or not, and come up with that as the appropriate threshold, 2 degrees C. And above that, we say, is dangerous. So if you think of the busiest road in Bristol, and what we're, at the moment, we're going for 50-50, which is what most legislation is built on at best. That's every second time you cross the road, you close your eyes. That's what we're aiming for. I mean, it'd be quite good for the emissions because it'd bring the curve down quite quickly.
Here is more from Dr. Kevin Anderson, Deputy Director of Britain's prestigious Tyndall Centre for Climate Research.
Despite this, the Committee on Climate Change, they're most optimistic. The UK government has a Committee on Climate Change, for those who aren't aware of this. It's said to be an independent committee. It's not really an independent committee, to be honest. But it is an important committee, and all credit to the UK government for establishing this, and all credit to the CCC. They do some very, very good work. I still think they very much sweeten the pill, and far too sweet, in my view. The Committee on Climate Change, their best budget is for 56% chance of exceeding 2 degrees C. So that's their best one. And the UK government adopted their not quite so optimistic one of a 63% chance of exceeding 2 degrees C. So we're all signed up to hold to 2 degrees C, but our policies are put in place for a really high chance of exceeding that target. And actually, for our national policies, we're being very, very unfair to the poorer parts of the world in terms of issues like deforestation and so forth. That should be much, we should have a much, much tighter constraint on that for the UK. If you want to ask me about that later, you can do. But we're being very unfair in some other parts of the world in making that decision. The argument I'd make is, can that 60-odd% chance of exceeding 2 degrees C, can that be reconciled with hold the temperature to below 2 degrees C, take action on the basis of science? Of course it can't. And yet scientists say nothing about it. Our job as scientists is to stand up and say, hang on, that doesn't really fit. The scientists repeatedly stay quiet. It's like old Thomas More's maxim. Now, silence is consent. In other words, we stay quiet because we're trying to keep our paymasters happy. By staying quiet, we agree with what's going on. So that process of consent, I think, is really quite invidious in the whole climate change story. At least there's some scientific framing for that. But let's think about this a bit further. What else have we typically seen? We see these sort of things all the time. Large reductions in emissions, 80% by 2050, by not in my term of office. I'll hand the problem on to my children. I'll have left being the CEO of the company by then. So we all like this. It's big reductions, big, great, grand schemes for somewhere a long way away, but we'll either be dead or retired. So, you know, this is something we all like. It has no premise in science. And yet scientists have repeatedly used this language and do not criticise it. They still repeatedly use it. One of the major funding councils for universities, the Scientific Funding Council, if you like, the EPSRC, uses this for overarching for its energy research. It has no premise on science, but it does fit with the policymakers' demands. The CO2 from this event is in the atmosphere for 100, 200 years, roughly. Keep these projectors on, the lights on. So we are changing the climate tonight. Whatever else we may do, we are changing the climate as we sit here now using fossil fuels to do this talk. 2050 targets, therefore, are irrelevant. It doesn't matter about what happens in 2050. It's about what happens today, what happens tomorrow. Really, what happened in the past as well, but we can't do much about that. So it's about the build-up of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and the other greenhouse gases. And that's really important. What matters are the cumulative emissions, the build-up of emissions day in, day out. That's what's important for climate change. Not some long-term mythical target, but nothing to do with science or climate change that keeps us all happy. So we have to move back towards cumulative emissions, carbon budgets. But that rewrites the chronology. It rewrites the timeline of climate change. It takes it away from wind turbines in 2030 or nuclear power, carbon capture and storage, other great schemes way off in the future. That these things are no longer adequate. What it tells you is you've got to do something immediately, urgent and radical reductions. You've got to come off the curve now. And you can't come off the curve with supply technologies, not quickly enough. Now, I'll be quite explicit here. I'm not saying the supply side is not important, but it cannot get you off the curve anywhere near fast enough. So you'll have much higher temperatures if we just rely on people like me, engineers, to come up with technologies that will solve the problem in 2025 or 2030. And remember, it's not just coming up with the technology, it's getting that technology to penetrate the energy system. And that can take decades. So it's not just having the good idea, it's making the good idea actually work. So how does this scientifically credible way of thinking of 2 degrees C, this idea of carbon budgets, how does that reframe the whole debate? Well, first, let's look at the latest data. It's not quite the latest data, and we can plot this for next year. It'll be worse next year, and it'll be worse the year after. So we all know this. And actually, this curve could be for anything to do with humans, really.
For the first time in 7 years, I have to ask for your help. I've always paid the whole cost of Radio EcoShock out of my pocket. Now my income has gone down while production and distribution costs are going up. You can help this radio program keep going by clicking on the donate button on our website at ecoshock.org or on the blog at ecoshock.info. My thanks to the listeners who have made that donation this past week. Radio EcoShock is the second biggest environment show anywhere. We run the world's largest free green audio download site. Become part of the program, won't you? Anderson says scientists have been keeping quiet about the tendency, one could even say plot, to underplay everything about the looming climate catastrophe.
The growth rate in CO2 for the last century was 2.7% per year. On average, it was 2.7%. Now, remember, that's a century when we didn't think about climate change, and the growth rate was 2.7. From 2000 to 2007, the growth rate was 3.5%. Remember, it's a growth rate of a bigger number as well. That's why it's exponential. So despite the fact we've been rambling on about climate change repeatedly, the rate of growth of CO2 has actually gone up, not down. And I said it was 5.9% in 2009 to 2010, dropped a little bit now. Now, what's interesting on top of that, it's really just pointing completely the wrong direction, exactly the opposite of the direction that we should be going in. This may not mean much to many of you, but Just to say that the models that we have a whole set of models about what might happen to the emissions in the future. And the highest set that we consider is, we did used to consider until quite recently, was appropriate for the future. Had a growth rate out to 2020. The scenarios go right the way up to the 2100. But their short-term growth rate was only 2.2%. So the highest ones that we model, and we didn't ever fully model those, we used lower ones at about 1 to 1.5%, weren't even in keeping with what the emissions that we were doing at the time were pointing in the direction they were pointing in. So we have always underplayed everything we possibly can. We've done exactly what the skeptics said, but in reverse. We've underplayed at every single occasion what we can do on climate change. And I'm particularly talking here about the scientists engaging with the emission scenarios, so not the other ones that do the more detailed bits of work that are really important behind all of this.
Kevin Anderson should know he's working every day with scientists from around the world who just keep quiet. Here, Anderson gives us an example of the number juggling in the 2006 Stern report delivered to the British government.
The earlier you can bring the emissions to a head and then bring them down, the lower the reduction rate has to be after the peak. By and large, there's a few caveats in that. If we peaked emissions, these are roughly a 50-50 chance of 2 degrees C, there or thereabouts. If we peaked emissions by 2015, then the Stern... many of you here heard of the Stern report? Quite an influential report. I don't know if you know, but the Stern report is premised on global emissions peaking in 2015. He didn't speak to Africa, India, China, anyone else like that. I'm sure he spoke to a few folk in Oxford. Yeah, and that is very typical. We take a very parochial view of the world. It used to be our world, but it's not really anymore. So 2015 peak. Now, this is our emissions here, and probably a few of you struggle to see this. These are our emissions going up here to this peak in 2015, then coming off. And then this bit here, you can never get emissions down to zero because you've got to feed the population. And feeding the population, as far as we can tell, you won't get the emissions down to zero because even just ploughing a field will release methane into the atmosphere. Fertilizer will put you N2O in the atmosphere. So there's all sorts of things to do with agriculture. Even if you make it very efficient, you're still going to have to get emissions. Remember, it's the area under the curve that matters. And there's a range of plots here, a range of curves that are drawn. And that's because science, that's all good science is quite uncertain.
In reality, once we factor in continuing emissions coming from things like agriculture and deforestation, there is no room left for emissions from us in the developed countries.
So if we take the one in the middle now, the 2021, and I'm going to strip out from that, because that was emissions of all sorts. I'm going to strip out deforestation emissions, I'm going to strip out the food emissions, and I'm pretty much going to leave us just with what's left for energy, the area that I focus on. Already, by 2012, in fact by 2010, we'd blown the budget. If we think of what the emissions are from deforestation over the century, we think of feeding 9 billion people, or 7 to 9 billion people over the century, and if we think of the emissions we put out between 2000 and 2010, we have no emissions left for energy for most of the scenarios. So we have to be on the optimistic end of the science. If you then plot that, what you'll see, the energy emissions have to go down to zero. Now that's interesting, because if the emissions go down to zero, you can't have any carbon capture and storage, and all these great schemes that are out there to try and take the CO2 out of coal or gas-fired power stations. Because you cannot get them down to zero. You can't get them near to zero. Probably somewhere between a 60 and 85% capture rate. In other words, 60 to 85% of the carbon dioxide going up the flue or in the fuel in the first place, you can strip out. But you're always going to get something, a 10%, a 15% residue. And you also, of course, you're going to have to get a lot more of it mined out of the ground because it makes the process a lot more inefficient. And as you mine coal or as you get gas, you will always get releases of hydrocarbon gases into the atmosphere. And you cannot stop that process. So you can't use carbon capture and storage. So all you can fit in this, I've been thinking about it, are biofuels, which have a lot of problems with them, your renewables, and nuclear. And they're all very low carbon, very low to zero carbon, as near as damn it. So it says a lot about what you have to do. By 2035 to 2040, around the globe, your cars, your planes, your fridges, everything, no carbon. Remember, this is a global plot, not for the wealthy parts of the world. So I now want to think about that. What does this mean for the wealthy parts of the world, the OECD countries, the Annex 1 countries?
Radio EcoShock will be right back with more from Dr. Kevin Anderson in a tell-all about climate silence at the highest levels as we accelerate over the cliff of global warming. Anderson is just getting warmed up. Stay tuned.